If an illiquid wrapper, such as private equity, can generate a premium, very simply, we will invest in that. As long as we can satisfy, as I mentioned before, our 4.25% a year distribution, you need to find that cash every year. So as long as I can satisfy that, then we can run illiquid assets, and we should do. It's a case of ensuring, again, that we are with people who have the talent, the access, and the ability to find these entrepreneurs, convince them that their involvement in helping them build their companies is sufficient. Venture is the risk you take on at the early stage when the companies are burning through cash, they're unprofitable. It takes a long time for these companies to transition away from cash burn mode into anything remotely close to profitability. People have these deep-rooted, deep-seated insecurities, which you'd think would have disappeared by now, but it still drives them. And so we look for that. This game is so competitive, whether it's venture capital or public equity investing, you name it. It's so competitive that we need to ensure we're with people who can go through those difficult times and stick with it.
Welcome to Money Maze Curated Podcasts. We created this spin-off channel to highlight a selection of innovative firms in the finance sector and beyond. At a time when education might never have been as valuable, and where debate and discussion never more necessary, Oxford, the oldest university in the English-speaking world, founded in 1096, remains at the epicenter of excellence. It's produced radical thinkers like John Wycliffe, who challenged the church's authority in the 14th century, Thomas More, whose utopia still provokes political theorists. In short, it's a place where orthodoxy and rebellion cohabitate and acts as a magnet for talent and capital. Such an exalted position should never be taken for granted, and the financial resilience which can help this legacy continue is supported in part by Oxford University Endowment Management, aka OUEM, who oversee a £6 billion endowment fund. And today's curated episode allows us the chance to talk to its new CIO, Nermal Mohsin. Nermal, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you for having me, Simon.
So we're going to discuss your investment approach, priorities and principles shortly, but you took on this role earlier in this year, having been deputy CIO since 2022. And as I did my research, and we do know you and your colleagues, I see, of course, you studied at Oxford and you joined OUEM in 2012. And I did say to myself, did you ever leave Oxford?
I did indeed. Well, thanks for having me, Simon, again. Yes, I left Oxford in 06. I should go back a step, actually, because what I did thereafter was informed by what I did in my gap year, actually. There was a fantastic scheme run by what was then Arthur Andersen. It was a scholarship scheme, which ultimately was taken on by Deloitte. They were years ahead of their peers in terms of a very progressive sense of how to find talent and try and capture them early on. And I spent a year before Oxford with a global intake of another 80 or so people across the world, basically working across all the service lines at what was then Arthur Andersen. So the consulting practice, which broke off and became Accenture, corporate finance, a bit of audit and so on and so forth. There's a wonderful exposure. You join the graduate intake. You're trained, in my case, it was in Italy. You were treated as if you were a first-year analyst out of university. So brilliant exposure. Did that as a gap year, but then they sponsored me to university. So you know, once I left university, I'd probably racked up about 18 months to 2 years of really good experience. And actually, it resulted in a bit of paralysis. I'd seen a lot, good and bad. And whilst my interest in business had never didn't wane in that period, it did give me a good sense of the reality of what was ahead of me. I think maybe slightly ahead of my peers in that respect. And so I was at the crossroads. But ultimately, I was onto a good thing. So I stuck it out in the corporate finance consulting world. I specifically did know that I wanted to understand how to value businesses. And so I spent the first couple of years working across a number of clients, helping to value business, whether it be on behalf of a private equity firm buying a business, or it could be an expert witness case where, you know, there's been some kind of semi-appropriation by a government of a corporate asset and it's gone to court and they need an expert witness to value the business and so on and so forth. So it gave me a really good sense of how you think about a business commercially and then do the kind of quant analysis to ascribe a value to it. And the key takeaway was that it's much more of an art than science. So that was the first couple of years. And then someone nodded to me and said, look, if you want to pivot your career, which I was looking to about two or three years in, to use those skills in a more tangible way than just consulting, they whispered to me that you might be interested in multi-asset investing because you're a man of broad interests. And they were quite right. A lot of my colleagues from the Andersen scheme actually went on to to private equity of some shape or form 2-3 years into their careers. And that never appealed to me. Very transactional environment. I wanted to keep it broad and wide. And so multi-asset came my way. I joined a family office in London. At that point, around a $2 billion family office. It gave me the chance to understand a whole different perspective of investing through the multi-asset lens. And I loved it. And very simply cold emailed the founding CIO at Oxford at that point, Sandra Robertson. I'd love to take part in this wonderful institution, this enterprise, I should say. And they weren't hiring at the time, but I think it was a year or so later, I joined, and the rest is history. That's 2012.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, for those who haven't listened to that episode with Sandra Roberts that we did a couple of years ago, we really talk about the genesis of Oxford University Endowment, which we're not going to talk about today, but it is, you know, fascinating. And she came from Wellcome, and what an important pool of capital, as we just sort of hinted at, which is over $6 billion today. Mm. But let's just focus in on the investment goal of OUEM, if you distill it.
Very simply, Simon, we have an investment objective which hasn't changed since inception. It's a 5% real return objective. It's not dissimilar to many of my peers. Difficult to achieve. I think the last 4 years in the UK, inflation, cumulative inflation has been at 25% over the last 4 years. That real return to beat that bogey of inflation and some is a lofty objective. And as a result of that 5% real return objective, we are heavily biased to equities, which we'll get into shortly. But beyond that 5% real return objective, what we're trying to do is ensure there's a stable income year on year for our underlying investors. We give back 4.25% of our NAV every year, of the rolling 20 quarters NAV every year to our underlying investors. And we're trying to balance on that thread of ensuring that we can satisfy assisting the operating budget of our investors on a year-on-year basis with that distribution, but at the same time, maintain the spending power of the overall endowment long-term, because we have beneficiaries who aren't even alive as yet. So there's a constant tension ensuring that we support the current crop of investors, the university and the colleges and other institutional investors, as well as keep an eye to ensure that 30, 40, 50 years hence, the endowment is fit for purpose to ensure that they can also satisfy their spending obligations.
As such an important and difficult dual challenge. You're making the disbursements, and as I went through your materials, I think you distributed close to £2 billion since inception. And yet, you know, you can't deplete that pool of capital because of all the future, you know, beneficiaries. Can we just for a second pause on, typically, how are they consumed? Who are the recipients of those distributions?
So we have 46 investors, including the Central University at Oxford. That includes 31 of the colleges at Oxford, a host of trusts, some institutions that aren't necessarily within that umbrella of Oxford, but the educational charities and other very mission-aligned investors. So 46 in total, and there's a host of things it supports. The university, I mean, it's self-explanatory, but it's research, it's scholarship, it's buildings that the university needs to put up. For some of our non-university investors, it's some wonderful social grassroots causes operating right up and down this country. So it's a range and host of things, which is one of the reasons why I jumped at the chance to take this seat.
So this is what we're described in the business as permanent capital, but I suppose the biggest risk, because we'll talk about risk in a minute, is the impairment, permanent impairment. And yet, of course, with that goal, you have to have a large risk tolerance. So let's talk about that asset allocation. And please correct me if I'm wrong here, but as I went through your materials, I might be right in saying that your allocations to private equity and public equity are similarly just around under 40% each.
That's right.
And let's just start by, how do you think about, you know, one versus the other, and under what circumstances do you shift?
Yeah, this is the debate that is raging right now amongst endowments, asset allocators like myself. The way we've thought about it, first principles, we don't subscribe to an asset allocation framework which forces us to have a certain grouping of assets in private equity, public equity, so on and so forth. It's much more first principles than that, which is, what is the best way to achieve our 5% real return objective long term? If an illiquid wrapper, such as private equity, can generate a premium, very simply, we will invest in that. As long as we can satisfy, as I mentioned before, our 4.25% a year distribution, you need to find that cash every year. So as long as I can satisfy that and ensure that the portfolio is managed such that in difficult periods, and there will be difficult periods, there have been difficult periods already in equity markets when the performance is weaker, we are still able to intelligently find that 4.25% any given year, then we can run illiquid assets, and we should do, as long as there's a sufficient premium. So it's less about a number, and it's more about, does it make sense for the portfolio? Can we find the talent that can achieve that premium? And if we can't, no need to play that game. We can play a completely different game. But I think the industry does suffer a little bit from overthinking the right asset allocation framework, because they think of things, my industry, think of things in abstract academic terms. Just because the computer says private equity should give you a 3-5% premium because it has done historically, there's no reason to believe that's the case going forward, number one, as an asset class in aggregate. But number two, there's absolutely no reason for you to think that you can pick, or you have access to the manager that will give you that premium. So the key thing is to ensure that the market structure is sufficient, which we can get into, to believe that that premium is there. But more importantly, that we can find and access the managers that can repeatably achieve that premium. If we can do that, we're happy to run that level of liquidity.
You make an important point, because I sit on a couple of these asset allocation committees, and I'm often slightly critical that those presenting data looking back will present public and private markets equally, where in the public domain we have 100 years of data, and in private equity we have, best 25 and maybe as much. So, and people in our industry can get too wedded to rigidities. Now, staying with the private sphere, I think you've had a lot of success in the venture space. And I wonder, I think that most of the data would show that the dispersion of returns in venture capital is much bigger than it is in others. How do you think about approaching the earlier stage businesses?
I mean, venture is interesting. This concept of the power law, which I'm sure all your listeners understand, which is that the value accrues disproportionately to very few players, exists most poignantly in venture. And knowing that means that LPs like myself have to swallow a bit of humility when it comes to how we play venture, knowing that not just there's a handful of venture capital firms that will disproportionately accrue most of the value, but there's a small handful of companies that will accrue the outlier value as well. So it's a case of ensuring, again, that we are with people who have the talent, the access, and the ability to find these entrepreneurs, convince them that their involvement in helping them build their companies is sufficient, and for the founders, these outlier founders, to be convinced by that. And the thing with venture is the risk you take on at the early stage, when the companies are burning through cash, they're unprofitable. It takes a long time for these companies to transition away from cash burn mode into anything remotely close to profitability. It can take at times, depending on whether they're kind of still in hyper-growth mode or willing to turn that growth spigot off for a period to turn into cash. It can take anywhere from 7 to 10 years, sometimes longer, to really genuinely get to a case of profitability. So for us, it's a case of patience, number one, to know that you're not going to get the validation of venture returns anywhere less than five, sort of 8 to 10 years, number one. And number two, to recognize, because it's so difficult and the power law exists, we have to be in those few GPs and venture capital firms that can sustainably do this. And there are only ever a few. And the data proves this out. It's a pretty horrible reading. If you're not in the top 10%, effectively, of venture capital groups, you may as well not play the game. And so, again, seeing that as an abstract asset class, I must be in venture because venture, the computer tells me venture will give me an outsized return or premium over public equity and buyout, is just the wrong way to look at it. Because you're not in the 10%, you'll be probably, you'll be under the median return that you get from even buyout.
Well, more broadly, of course, you partner with lots of firms across the asset spectrum. Yes. Oxford has the magic and the magnetism of being, you know, in an unusual yes. position, and you will have a yes. lot of people beating down the door
yes.
to talk to you. Just, I'd like to just understand a little bit about what are the characteristics of those with whom you partner that really matter to you?
It's interesting that on the venture side specifically, Simon?
No, I mean, generally. Much more broadly, yes.
To distill it to a few characteristics, one is complete and utter focus. You've interviewed so many people. I've listened to many of your podcasts. You'll recognize this, Simon. It's very difficult to ex ante understand whether someone is exhibiting focus or just presenting very well, presenting a certain energy. Are they energetic or are they really resolutely focused? Are they single-minded in what they're trying to do? And good intentions and great energy can mask that really well. So people like me who are trying to run a lean portfolio and partner with a relatively small number of managers, we've got 60 roughly active managers in our portfolio, maybe 35 of any major size. We're pretty lean in our approach. And it means that bar for focus has to be really high. That's the first thing. Focus in terms of what they're doing, a single-mindedness, and then a top one percentile of competitiveness. And again, ex ante to work out, is this person in that 1%? They just live and die by the scoreboard. We did a lot of work to get to, I mean, we can talk about the work we do to try and get to the right conclusion as regards focus and competitiveness. But I'm running through the attributes.
Yes.
And the final is alignment. We want skin in the game, but not just capital, but philosophically. I think a lot of people can say, well, they're putting a lot of their net worth in. So, if we feel the pain, they feel the pain. That's one type of alignment. It's a blunt instrument because you can put a lot of money into fund. But philosophically, you might not be aligned with us. Philosophically, actually, despite the amount of money you got in the fund, you actually may be running that fund with a slightly lower risk tolerance than maybe you exhibited when we invested, because you're much more in risk preservation mode.
Right.
You're not in get rich mode, you're in stay rich mode, despite that high alignment monetarily. So we're looking for that very difficult combination of they still are really, thumping the table to be in the Hall of Fame returns. And also they got all their money at risk. So alignment, focus, and competitiveness.
It's so interesting because I think what I'm hearing is that, and this is why it is so difficult for so many people, it's part art, part science. It's
yes.
part qualitative and part Completely. Quantitative. What are you, when you're in those conversations with your colleagues, what are the things that maybe aren't quantitative that chime?
From a personal attribute basis, and I'll get to the track record and what you can delineate, which goes beyond just the headline numbers of any track record, which I think is also important. But let's just stick with personal attributes first of all. There are often payoffs. People who are in the top 1% of competitiveness, you'll find this with athletes and anyone, elite musicians. You go through the list of anyone who's elite in their craft, there are payoffs. And the payoffs will be clear by way of a number of different things. The sacrifices they've gone through to achieve their goals historically, as regards this particular mission, in this case, it's investing. We look for that. What have you done? How did you go the extra mile? How do you reference with former colleagues and otherwise? You're looking for references which are outlier references. This person just worked that much harder. They put that much more work and effort in to hone their craft. And it came through in the numbers. The other one is you do want... And pretty much all our managers in our portfolio do have this. It doesn't always come through immediately, but a major chip on their shoulder. It's a really. It doesn't mean to say that if you've had a comfortable life and all the rest of it, you're not going to have that sense of, say, insecurity,
okay.
Because you get people who've had perfectly stable CVs, stable lifestyles. You can't really evince anything from their backgrounds as to what was the trauma that drove you. But there's still a chip on the shoulder. And the chip on the shoulder can be anything from, I'll give you some examples. We've got someone in the portfolio right now who says to me, and he made a fortune, he's done amazing well for himself and his investors. He's still, in the back of his mind, still trying to validate himself from his in-laws' perspective. He married up and he's got that chip on his shoulder. My father-in-law will never accept me. And he's done extraordinarily well. That's his chip on the shoulder. That's one example. For someone else, it's the fear of poverty. That still drives him, despite the fact that he's worth a lot of money at the moment. So people have these deep-rooted, deep-seated insecurities, which you'd think would have disappeared by now, but it still drives them. And so we look for that. And in fact, it's actually a question, we've got like a DD checklist. What is the chip on the shoulder? Have we asked the question? Have they given us an appropriate answer? And it's amazing that people, you know, will open up. It takes a bit of time, but they'll open up. And we're looking for that. We're looking for exactly for that edge, that personality edge, because this game is so competitive, whether it's venture capital or public equity investing, you name it. It's so competitive that we need to ensure we're with people who can go through those difficult times and stick with it.
So that is fascinating. I think we could have, you know, almost a whole conversation just on, you know, how you share that with the team. When we had Nikolai Tangen on the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, he talked about, you know, the importance of psychology in the investing equation. And I think many people have come at it, you know, through the numbers or in other ways that are different from yours and possibly not as effective. Public equities, endless discussions about active, passive. What are the circumstances when you really prefer to be active? What and where?
Oh, it's another really good question. Again, it's raging debate on my side of the table. We're not ideologically wedded to the active passive. It's they're tools in a toolbox, and the toolbox is varied as regards to how you play public markets, and they both have a function. Our general approach is, given our ability to access world-class talent, and again, it goes back to what's in your toolbox. We have, fortunately at Oxford, a deep and wide toolbox when it comes to active managers. Whilst in aggregate, there's lots of data out there and studies, quite rightly, that after fees, most active managers underperform. That is the case. But if you're us or anyone like us who can access these top-class managers, what you find in the data is there are many, many managers who routinely continuously outperform. And so whilst the aggregate data isn't on our side, arguably, we're not playing that game. We're playing the game of, can we find this unique talent? Because they do exist. We have a number in our portfolio that have consistently on a 3, 5, 10 year basis over the long term, annualized 2, 3, 4% ahead of an appropriate benchmark. It's doable, they're out there. And for as long as they're out there and we can find them, we will back active managers. However, what we're not going to do is, in the name of some ideological belief that it must always be active and active is the only way to play this game, we will force, you know, activity in our portfolio. That's not the case. So we do have, for example, we have a chunk of passive exposure in our portfolio. And why? It's because we have around 35% in public equity at the moment. And for various reasons, if we cannot find a slot for an active manager in our portfolio, it's no problem at all. We've got the market there, which is available to us. We have beta there. It's cheap and it's free. And it's a holding period for when we can and when we do find someone who can take that mantle of an active slot in our portfolio. So it's we use it really as an asset allocation tool. What we're not saying is we'll go passive or active. But we have a very, very strong belief that active works. And I think a lot of LPs on my side, if I was to just be self-critical, it goes to Daniel Kahneman's, I'm sure I've seen his book on your bookshelf. But this aspect of people overestimate how good they are.
Yeah.
80% of drivers think they're above average. doesn't work. 30% have got to go in the bottom half. And the same goes with LPs. This is the issue, is that not only do you find active managers think they're above average in terms of stock picking, you have LPs who think they're above average. So you have a compounding aspect here of you know the universe out there is a difficult one to choose from. But let's just say we can hunt, and we do at Oxford, we like to think we hunt in a pretty small subset of absolute world quality talent. Even within that talent pool, you're going to find folks who don't work out. So you're backing yourself to be above average. And most LPs will say, of course we are. None of my team are going to walk into a team meeting and say, I think I've got a below average idea. It's everyone's backing themselves. And so this is why the process is so important. Our investment process, knowing what I've just said, that it's difficult to hit above average. And everyone thinks they're above average. Knowing that, how do we ensure that we pick the best people out there and they themselves their process, as in the manager's process, their discipline is going to maintain their pole position. Because we can't eat, you know, we're looking for future returns here. And so the past track record gives you some sense of how they may do. But any given week, month, we're scrubbing down the portfolio, Simon, and saying, does this manager who's got, had extraordinary returns over the last 10 years, are the best 10 years behind them?
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty of this craft.
You've hinted at it, but I know that over the last decade plus, the team has been broadened, widened, strengthened, deepened. How do you instill some of these super important principles while sharing the good and the bad? You know, just tell me a little bit about how you are managing the team, what you expect of them, how you slice and dice the talent.
In my team specifically, there's a couple of things. So the personal attributes I referred to before that we look for, I look for in my team. It's fully aligned. Focus, alignment, competitiveness. If you're not top decile, in my estimation, across those three, Oxford's not a place for you. But in terms of actual investing principles and how we manage the team to ensure that we have a process which is repeatable to find this world-class talent out there, whether it's in buyout or venture or public equity, it's an insatiable curiosity. My team, they don't switch off from thinking about investing in companies and managers and motivations and all the rest of it at 5 p.m. You know, I know for a fact we're slacking each other or teasing each other way into the evening. And not because of any demands to do so, it's because the team are just curious. They want to share. Did you guys know about this company? Do you know what's happening with it in AI right now? Do you know all this kind of stuff? And so that curiosity is crucial. And so one of the things I do is I embrace that. But we need to have guardrails around that because you can just look at everything and you know, result in a poor return on time investment process. So what we're constantly trying to do, what I'm trying to do constantly is say, right, I want the curiosity, insatiable curiosity. I want the competitiveness to get the best things in the portfolio. How do we strap some rails around that to ensure everyone's focused? And the focus comes down to, as I said, this war for talent that me and everyone else out there, other LPs like myself, are looking for constantly. So it's keeping that bar very high. It's constantly reminding the team of those principles of talent we're looking for. It's constantly creating our networks because it's very rare we come across talent that comes inbound. It's more often than not, it's us going out there or it's a nod and a nudge from a pre-qualified, close-knit orbit of like-minded people. Whose views we respect. That's often how we find great talent. It's the concentric circles of very good people often result in finding other good people. So we ensure that that is constantly curated. And then vulnerability. You asked how on the team, I want and need people to ensure that there's a safe environment. You can be vulnerable. You can say, I got this wrong. You should be able to do 180. You may have had a view on a manager or a strategy or a fund or a track record or whatever it may be, which now is not so strongly held, that view. And so I think if we have a team who all feel that they're safe to be vulnerable in that respect, I think it makes for a far stronger ability to weed out the poor ideas, the middling ideas, the mediocre ideas from the absolutely brilliant ones. So basically honesty. And I think a lot of institutions struggle with this. It's just a very human thing. There's so many conflicts. You're trying to project a certain confidence. You're trying to compete with your peers. You're trying to get a fantastic thing in the portfolio and want validation for that. There's all these things which can conflict at times with what the ultimate goal of this endowment is. 5% real return in a sensible way over the long term. It doesn't, that objective doesn't always align with the egos of people on your team.
Course.
And mine included, by the way.
Right.
So I'm constantly checking egos, myself, my own story, and my team to ensure that stays at the door. What's the truth of the matter as regards this particular investment? Forget your biases or your desire not to look wrong. Just a long response, but it's really important because it's the art of judging people as much as it is the art of judging the track record and data.
And I have observed some of the great managers, what they seem to possess, which I never did as a manager, is that steely objectivity that allows them to walk away from a position, notwithstanding the vested time, interest, ego, and the rest of it. The other thing, though, is you sit in Oxford. Mm. There is so much IP and, overwhelming. How do you access what you want from such talent? And I'm talking here ideas that might flow from, there's recently been Organ Oxford came out of Oxford University on liver transplantation and, lots of others, quantum, computing. How do you, and as a team, think, well, we're sitting here, in a fantastic engine room?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, and we are so fortunate. We are so, so fortunate. Oxford's a very big place. It's home to some extraordinary scholarship, entrepreneurial minds and so on, so founders, potential founders. We have our various nodes, Simon. We have various individuals within the infrastructure of the university who we call upon, experts in AI, expert in AI and ethics, for example, a big topic at the moment. What direction might that go in? Material science is one which is quite interesting. We've spoken to people at the university about this before. Usually to get a read on a theme which we're seeing from a bottom-up perspective that a great manager, for example, that we've come across has shown us. They might be investing around a certain theme. And what we're trying to do is say, hold on, we're at Oxford. We can try and get a sense as to if this theme is real, what's the hot air around it, what are the difficulties around addressing how big the market will be for this theme. So there are various voices in and around the university who are good citizens that we call upon. But at the same time, Simon, we do try and keep a healthy and an appropriate arm's length approach. For hopefully obvious reasons. We are running money for the university and its colleges. And I think if you invite a lot of people into that process, you unwittingly, again, these could be poor return on time conversations if you do it willy-nilly. So we try and be very targeted with individuals. And we have so many people who are keen to help the endowment, keen to give up the time. We've just got to make sure that we pass through the individuals in our network appropriately.
So as we look out, the world is, beset with worries and opportunities. And I know that you've, as a group, have been very careful not to get sucked into the macro debates that can influence some investment committees. What is maybe newer on the investment menu that is intriguing you or you're spending some time looking at? And that can be asset class or it can be theme.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you find very talented investors, we do, that's our model. It's predominantly finding these external investment groups. What you find is that they themselves organically will shift things for you. So whether it's a geography tilt, things are looking more interesting for a given manager, given through their framework of, I like a certain kind of company that is going to be super resilient, has pricing power, great returns on capital, and so on and so forth. I'll look for that anywhere on the globe. That's the mandate we've given them. Or I should say that's the mandate they have and we've endorsed. Within that mandate, they can shift from the US to Europe. And so we don't need to really have a particularly strong view that, oh, Europe's looking interesting at the moment, guys. Let's flick to Europe. That's not the game we're playing. So that's one aspect. So the organic shifts happening at the underlying are happening without our need to opine on those things. What we are doing at a thematic level is that we are playing to our strengths in terms of size. So with 6 billion today, there's a lot of conversation, for example, in private equity about how the next 10 years will be a lot more difficult. And that may well be the case for these huge, mega, large cap buyout funds that exist. And so thematically, one of the things we're keen on is ensuring that we are focused on an appropriately sized fund where they can hunt in regions that these big, large cap buyout guys can't. And in fact, what you find is that actually these smaller funds and vehicles that we tend to prefer, they can often sell into this massive wall of capital that exists. So that's not necessarily a theme. That's the structure that we've had for some time. Our size affords us that structural advantage. And as regards some of the areas we find particularly interesting, I mean, innovation runs through our portfolio. You mentioned venture, 16%. It's a theme, but it's a broad theme. Again, you find talented people, they'll give you themes in AI to food technology to, as I said, to material science and so on and so forth. So we are exploring a number of themes in our portfolio via the managers we have.
So I think that what's been clear even in this conversation is this flexibility, lack of dogma.
Yes.
looking for the managers that you have very carefully selected to pursue their own, you know, predilections. When you get a change in the way people think about sustainability and the green world, and obviously we've got cross currents right now, do you again just leave it to the managers to do what they do well, or what stage do you want to actually, if not intervene, you know, sort of, you know, just move the tiller?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we integrate ESG considerations right into the DNA of our process. There isn't a checklist we go through which says, well, this is ESG compliant as per the definition of some outside body, and therefore it goes in our portfolio. That is not what we subscribe to as an approach. So there's a holistic way in which we integrate it. We engage with our managers at the very outset. Diligence, we have a number of different areas we ask them about. Some of them have formal ESG policies. Others don't codify it, but they actually do it. They do a brilliant job of considering all these things as regards to the environment, social considerations and governance considerations. And they need help, actually from us sometimes as LPs to actually help codify it and verbalize it. So it flows through our process. We're constantly engaging once something's in our portfolio. So at the underlying company level, a lot of analysis is done, whether it's public companies or otherwise, as to where these companies fare in respect of the moves they're making, either to improve or to satisfy certain environmental, social, governance obligations. And Antonia and her team do a great job of this. So there's a constant, what I'm trying to outline here, that there's a constant engagement. It's not a, you know, one and done at the very start and it's in the portfolio. It continues. It's a conversation. It's a dialogue. And the ESG landscape and sustainability landscape itself is shifting. Definitions are shifting all the time. Ways in which we think about these things are shifting, which is why we never wanted to wed ourselves to a black and white definition. Certainly if the independent arbiters of that definition themselves are hazy in how they define these things. So we try to keep things appropriately flexible, but it does flow through our process.
And taking over as CIO this year of a very successful entity, what do you think might be the emphasis or newer approaches that you might want to take on board over the next few years?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's and this won't wow you, but there's always an attempt and a desire. You take the helm of a place and you want to put your stamp on it. I think the principles won't change in terms of how I want to do things. And I've gone through a lot of things already in this conversation. Those principles are to my mind, timeless principles. In terms of how we shift the portfolio and things they may do differently, it's more a case of learning from prior lessons, my own mistakes, and ensuring we avoid those, decrease them, ensuring we have a process which allows us to see around the corner a bit more when it comes to amber flags, let's say, for certain positions, which we can afford to have more courage to move on from instead of extending too much patience, because we're very patient investors. We like to give people the benefit of the doubt. They have a tough time performance-wise, no problem at all. That comes with the territory. You're putting your risk on, you're running a certain level of concentration, you're going to have bad years. But there's always that gray. Is that a weak performance patch, something which can be overcome? It's a blip. Or is there something structurally deficient in their diligence process? So where I'm going with this is that things I want to do differently is to try and ensure, again, to my point before, the team and the process are weeding out these little signals earlier and moving and acting on them. I can give you a litany of mistakes that I've made.
So we know the investment industry loves to talk about its successes and can be remarkably quiet about its less successful moments. I think it was Charlie Munger who said that, you know, greatest loss of memory is found in the investment industry. But your own mistakes, what would you say as an investor over these years are the one or two things that you've most taken on board?
I think, for me at least, it's having as strict a sell discipline as you have a buy discipline. People are very good at, you know, before something goes in the portfolio, the amount of work they do, the referencing and so on and so forth. Once it's in, yes, we evaluate very closely, but I think there is a discipline around selling, and it's harder for all the obvious reasons. You want to confirm your bias, you believe in what you've put in the portfolio. the amber flags, there's a bit of a rose-tinted, you know, kind of approach to looking at those ambers. Yep. Is that an amber or is that potentially a green, actually? Could the amber conflict to a green? As opposed to may the amber flick to a red?
Yep.
And what are the things that may result in a flick to a red? Can we, before it flicks to a red, the amber flag we've discovered, make a judgment call ahead of that? Difficult, because we are in the game of not just numbers and returns that we get from these managers. We're in the game of ascertaining a whole bunch of qualitative things under the bonnet, the motivation, the alignment, and so on and so forth. So that's one aspect. And I think there's a few examples where I think I have overstayed my welcome. And again, when the performance is weaker, your immediate response to that as a long-term investor is say, well, you say you don't cut the trade. You understand what's going on here. You want to be patient. So you weather that bout of weak performance. But you're also thinking at the same time that, okay, but is that weak performance an indication of something which is long-term problematic? And there was one situation where it happened to be about a weak performance, which didn't really bother me. I thought, well, you know, that's part and parcel of the game. But there were some diligence mistakes. There were when you went through some of the crystallization of losses. This wasn't just a case of mark-to-market weak performance.
Right, right.
Crucially for me was actually run me through what you sold of late and why. And actually there were a couple of mea culpas. Like, well, do you know what? The little diligence said X. We realized it was wrong because the share price has fallen off a cliff. But more importantly, the two or three things that they hung their hat on before the market realized we're wrong. Again, that happens.
Yeah.
But if you see that two, three times, if you get a sense that the depth of the work isn't quite there, or they're distracted by other things. In this case, it was some team turnover this manager was dealing with. They were also looking at a sub-vertical, a strategy they were trying to build out. So these are all, again, amber flags. Mm-hmm. None of them necessarily a bad thing. Team turnover happens. You want to set up a new strategy, sub-strategy? No problem if you've earned the stripes to do so. Weak performance, no problem, in of themselves. You put that in a cauldron, give it a whiz around, you think, hold on, is there something going on here? And when you don't get the clarity of response, this is where the judgment call comes in.
Yep.
Some people earn the stripes to pivot, to move, to evolve their strategy, to evolve their business in some cases. And others, frankly, don't, and they haven't earned their stripes. And so we try and ensure that when we're making these judgment calls, when we're trying to weed out the amber flags that might turn to a red before they turn to a red, that we're doing it in a very principled way, a very dispassionate way. And in this case, I got it wrong. There was a number of things, and probably asked them welcome for another couple of years with the view that, oh, well, you know, they'll bounce back. And they never really did. Lost team members, performance kind of stayed pretty mediocre. Yeah. Ultimately, we pulled the cord.
Yeah. But as you said, if you manage to embed in the culture that sense of openness, that honesty about position reversal mistakes, you know, that's important, because this is a business so wound and tied up with pride as well.
Oh, completely.
You know, as I reflect on your observations and the mission of, you know, your colleagues and the success that you've had, a few things strike me. One is there's no dogma underlying your approach, because flexibility in a number of disciplines you've talked about seems to be, you know, a critical variable. I like the fact that you are establishing in the investment team this culture of being, you know, you say vulnerable, but it is the ability to just say, hey, you know, guys, I got this wrong. We need to think about it again, without being damned by it or letting it eat you up, because those are the other sort of elements of the business. The characteristics about the managers with whom you like to partner, I like the fact you want energy for sure, but focus. And sometimes the two can blur. And this is a business where the presentation of the underlying investment success often can just pull you off a little bit. You know, what's going on in the engine as well, and all those things that you've talked about, you know, just reinforce the fact this is part art, part science.
Yeah.
The data tells you so much. And that... you look for the same characteristics in your colleagues and the team that you've been building out. And if there is one word that struck me, which is, you know, very central to your thinking about the investment landscape, it's innovation and how that is going to impart and create investment opportunities and hopefully investment returns.
Mm.
So now I really enjoyed talking to you today and hearing about how this business is evolving, and these investment businesses are all evolving. And I wish you the very best of luck for the future.
Thank you very much, Simon.
All content on the Money Maze curated podcast are for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is accurate at the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the contents. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed. Additionally, please note that the Money Maze curated podcasts are funded by the interviewee or their featured organization, unlike the Money Maze podcast, which is funded by third-party advertising.